This is the Ministry of Truth. I'm Gordon Comstock. Time for part three of the United States is Still a British Colony by James Montgomery. A military flag. And to further confirm and understand the significance of what I have told you in the previous two episodes, you need to understand the fringe on the United States flag. Read the following. First, the appearance of our flag is defined in Title 4, Section 1, USC. Quote, "The flag of the United States shall be 13 horizontal stripes, alternate red and white, and the union of the flag shall be 48 stars, white in a blue field." Unquote. Parentheses, my note. Of course, when new states are admitted, new stars are added in parentheses. A footnote was added on page 1113 of the same section, which says, quote, "Placing of fringe on the national flag, the dimensions of the flag, and arrangement of the stars are matters of detail not controlled by statute, but within the discretion of the President as Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy." Unquote. The President, as military commander, can add a yellow fringe to our flag. When would this be done? During a time of war. Why? A flag with a fringe is an ensign. A military flag. Read the following. Quote, "Pursuant to USC Chapter 1, 2, and 3, Executive Order Number 10834, August 21, 1959, 24FR6865. A military flag is a flag that resembles the regular flag of the United States, except that it has a yellow fringe bordered on three sides. The President of the United States designates this deviation from the regular flag by executive order and in his capacity as Commander-in-Chief of the Armed Forces." Unquote. From the National Encyclopedia, Volume 4. Quote, "Flag, an emblem of a nation, usually made of cloth and flown from a staff. From a military standpoint, flags are of two general classes. Those flown from stationary masts over army posts, and those carried by troops in formation. The former are referred to by the general name flags. The latter are called colors when carried by dismounted troops. Colors and standards are more nearly square than flags and are made of silk with a knotted fringe of yellow on three sides." Dot, dot, dot. Use of the flag. The most general and appropriate use of the flag is as a symbol of authority and power, unquote. The following quote is from Bouvier's Law Dictionary, 1914, quote, "The agency of the master is devolved upon him by the law of the flag. The same law that confers his authority ascertains its limits. And the flag at the masthead is noticed to all the world of the extent of such power to bind the owners or freighters by his act. The foreigner who deals with this agent has notice of that law, and if he be bound by it, there is not injustice. His notice is the national flag which is hoisted on every sea, and under which the master sails into every port. And every circumstance that connects him with the vessel isolates that vessel in the eyes of the world and demonstrates his relation to the owners and freighters as their agent for a specific purpose, and with power well defined under the National Maritime Law, unquote. Don't be thrown by the fact they are talking about the sea and that it doesn't apply to land. Admiralty law came onto land in 1845 with the Act of 1845 by Congress. Next, a quote from the court case Roostrat versus People. Quote, pursuant to the law of the flag, a military flag does result in jurisdictional implication when flown. The plaintiff cites the following. Under what is called international law, the law of the flag, a ship owner who sends his vessel into a port gives notice by his flag to all who enter into contracts with the shipmaster that he intends the law of the flag to regulate those contracts with the shipmaster that he either submit to its operation or not contract with him or his agent at all, unquote. I have had debates with folks that take great issue with what I have said. They dogmatically say the Constitution is the law and the government is outside the law. I wish they were right. But they fail to see or understand that the American people have been conquered, unknowingly, yet conquered all the same. That is why a judge will tell you not to bring the Constitution into his court or a law dictionary, because he is the law, not the Constitution. You have only to read the previous Senate's report on national emergency to understand that the Constitution and our constitutional form of government no longer exists. Further evidence. Social Security. I fail to understand how the American people could have been so dumbed down as to not see that the Social Security system is fraudulent and that it is based on socialism, which is the redistribution of wealth right out of the Communist Manifesto. The Social Security system, first, is fraud. It is insolvent and was never intended to be solvent. It is used for a national identification number and a requirement to receive benefits from the conqueror, i.e. king. The Social Security system is made to look and act like insurance. All insurance is governed by admiralty law, which is the king's way of binding those involved with commerce with him. The following quote is from Helvering versus Davis. Quote, the Social Security system may be accurately described as a form of social insurance enacted pursuant to Congress's power to spend money in aid of the general welfare, unquote. The following quote is from Federal Judge Story in Delovio versus Boyd from 1815. Quote, my judgment accordingly is that policies of insurance are within the admiralty and maritime jurisdiction of the United States, unquote. You need to know and understand what contribution means in FICA, the Federal Insurance Contribution Act. Read the following definition. Contribution, from Black's Law Dictionary, 6th edition. The right of one who has discharged a common liability to recover of another also liable, the aliquot portion which he ought to pay or bear. Under principle of contribution, a tortfeasor against whom a judgment is rendered is entitled to recover proportional shares of judgment from other joint tortfeasor whose negligence contributed to the injury and who were also liable to the plaintiff. The share of a loss payable by an insurer when contracts with two or more insurers cover the same loss. The insurer's share of a loss under a coinsurance or similar provision. The sharing of a loss or payment among several. The act of any one or several of a number of co-debtors, co-sureties, etc., in reimbursing one of their number who has paid the whole debt or suffered the whole liability, each to the extent of his proportionate share, unquote. Thereby making you obligated for the national debt. The social security system is one of the contractual nexuses between you and the king. Because you are involved in the king's commerce and have asked voluntarily for his protection, you have accomplished the following. You have admitted that you are equally responsible for having caused the national debt and that you are a wrongdoer as defined by the above definition. You have admitted to being a 14th Amendment citizen who only has civil rights granted by the king. By being a 14th Amendment citizen, you have agreed that you do not have standing in court to question the national debt. Keep in mind, this is beyond the status of our country and people, which I covered earlier in this paper. We are in this system of law because of the conquest of our country. Congress has transferred its constitutional obligation of coining money to the Federal Reserve, the representatives of the king. This began after the Civil War and the overturning of the U.S. Constitution as a result of conquest. You have used this fiat money without objection, which is a commercial benefit supplied by the king's bankers. Fiat money has no real value other than the faith in it, and you cannot pay a debt with fiat money because it is a debt instrument. A Federal Reserve note is a promise to pay and is only evidence of debt. The benefit you have received is you are allowed to discharge your debt, which means you pass on financial servitude to someone else. The someone else is our children. When you go to the grocery store and hand the clerk a $50 Federal Reserve note, you have stolen the groceries and passed $50 of debt to the seller. Americans try to acquire as much of this fiat money as they can. If Americans were aware of this, it wouldn't matter to them because they don't care if the merchandise is stolen as long as it is legal. But what happens if the system fails? Those with the most fiat money or real property, which was obtained with fiat money, will be forfeited to the king. Everything that was obtained with this fiat money reverts back to the king. I will explain in the conclusion of this paper. Because use of his fiat money is a benefit supplied by the king's bankers, it all therefore transfers back to the king. The king's claim to the increase in the country comes from the original charter of 1606. But it is all hidden. Black is white and white is black. Wealth is actually debt and financial slavery. For those that do not have a social security number or think they have rescinded it, you are no better off. Well, there goes George Gordon's argument, I think. As far as the king is concerned, you are subject to him also. Why? Well, just to list a couple of reasons other than conquest, you use his money, and as well, Gordon doesn't do that. And as I said before, this is discharging debt without prosecution. You use the goods and services that were obtained by this fiat money. Well, maybe Gordon's all right. He doesn't do that either. To enrich your lifestyle and sustain yourself. You drive or travel, whichever definition you want to use, on the king's highways and roads for pleasure and to earn a living, meaning you are involved in the king's commerce. On top of these reasons, which are based on received benefits, this country has been conquered. I know a lot of patriots won't like this. Your argument has been that the government has and is operating outside of the law, i.e., the United States Constitution. Believe me, I don't like sounding like the devil's advocate, but as far as international law goes, and the laws that govern war between countries, the King or Queen of England rule this country, first by financial servitude, and then by actual conquest and military occupation. The Civil War was the beginning of the conquest, as evidenced by the 14th Amendment. This amendment did several things, as already mentioned. It created the only citizenship available to the conquered and declared that these citizens had no standing in any court to challenge the monetary policies of the new government. Why? So the king would always receive his gain from his commercial venture. The amendment also eliminated your use of the natural rights and gave the conquered civil rights. The conquered are governed by public policy instead of republic of self-government under God Almighty. Your argument that this can't be is frivolous and without merit. The evidence is conclusive. Nothing has changed since before the Revolutionary War. All persons whose activities in King's commerce are such that they fall under this marine-like environment are into an invisible admiralty jurisdiction contract. Admiralty jurisdiction is the king's commerce of the high seas. And if the king is a party to the sea-based commerce, such as by the king having financed your ship, or the ship is carrying the king's guns, then that commerce is properly governed by the special rules applicable to admiralty jurisdiction. But as for that slice of commerce going on out on the high seas without the king as a party, that commerce is called maritime jurisdiction, and so maritime is the private commerce that transpires in a marine environment. At least, that distinction between admiralty and maritime is the way things once were, but no more. What Lincoln and Jefferson said about the true American danger was very prophetic. This quote is from Abraham Lincoln, quote, "All the armies of Europe, Asia, and Africa combined could not, by force, take a drink from the Ohio or make a track on the Blue Ridge in a trial of 1,000 years. At what point, then, is the approach of danger to be expected? I answer, if it ever reach us, it must spring up amongst us. It cannot come from abroad. If destruction be our lot, we ourselves must be its author and finisher." Unquote. The following quote is from Thomas Jefferson. Quote, "Our rulers will become corrupt, our people careless. The time for fixing every essential right on a legal basis is now, while our rulers are honest and ourselves united. From the conclusion of this war, we shall be going downhill. It will not then be necessary to resort every moment to the people for support. They will be forgotten, therefore, and their rights disregarded. They will forget themselves, but in the sole faculty of making money, and will never think of uniting to effect a due respect for their rights. The shackles, therefore, which shall not be knocked off at the conclusion of this war, will remain on us long, will be made heavier and heavier, till our rights shall revive or expire in a convulsion. Unquote. Below are the political platforms of the Democrats and the Republicans. As you can see, there is no difference between the two. Plain socialism either way. They are both leading America to a world government, just as Cornwallis said, and that government will be the British Empire, or promoted by the British. The following is from the Democratic Party platform of 1936. Quote, "We have built foundations for the security of those who are faced with the hazards of unemployment and old age, for the orphaned, the crippled, and the blind. On the foundation of the Social Security Act, we are determined to erect a structure of economic security for all our people, making sure that this benefit shall keep step with the ever-increasing capacity of America to provide a high standard of living for all its citizens." Unquote. The following is from the Republican Party platform of 1936. It's a bit longer here. Quote, "Real security will be possible only when our productive capacity is sufficient to furnish a decent standard of living for all American families and to provide a surplus for future needs and contingencies. For the attainment of that ultimate objective, we look to the energy, self-reliance, and character of our people, and to our system of free enterprise. Society has an obligation to promote the security of the people by affording some measure of protection against involuntary unemployment and dependency in old age. The New Deal policies, while purporting to provide social security, have in fact endangered it. We propose a system of old age security based upon the following principles. 1. We approve a pay-as-you-go policy, which requires of each generation the support of the aged and the determination of what is just and adequate. 2. Every American citizen over 65 should receive a supplemental payment necessary to provide a minimum income sufficient to protect him or her of want. 3. Each state and territory, upon complying with simple and general minimum standards, should receive from the federal government a graduated contribution in proportion to its own, up to a fixed maximum. 4. To make this program consistent with sound fiscal policy, the federal revenues for this purpose must be provided from the proceeds of a direct tax widely distributed. All will be benefited, and all should contribute. We propose to encourage adoption by the states and territories of honest and practical measures for meeting the problems of employment insurance, the unemployment insurance, and old age annuity of the present Social Security Act are unworkable and deny benefits to about two-thirds of our adult population, including professional men and women, and all engaged in agriculture and domestic service, and the self-employed, while imposing heavy tax burdens upon all." Unquote. Both platforms appear in National Party Platforms, 1840 to 1972. compiled by Ronald Miller in 1973. Conclusion. Jesus gave us the most profound warning and advice of all time. Hosea 4:6. My people are destroyed by a lack of knowledge. This being our understanding and spiritual development in His Word. When applied to many facets of life, His Word exposes all of life's pitfalls. Jesus Christ's Word covers all aspects of life. The working class during the 1700s were far more educated than now, but this was still not enough to protect them from the secret subterfuge practiced by the lawyers and bankers. Only with understanding of Jesus Christ's word can the evil application of man's law be exposed and understood for what it is. This is why Jesus also warned of the beguilement of the lawyers and the deceit and deception they practice. Another reason the working class have been unable to understand their enslavement is because of the time spent working for a living. At wages supplied by the upper class, sufficient to live and even prosper, but never enough to attain upper class status. This is basic class warfare. This system is protected by the upper class controlling public education to limit and focus the working class's knowledge to maintain class separation. What does this have to do with this paper? Everything. This is the reason our upper class forefathers submitted to the king in the Treaty of 1783. After this treaty, and up to the Civil War, the working class were busy making this the greatest country in the history of the world. You see, they believed they were free. And a free man will work much harder than a man that is subject or a slave. As a whole, the working class were not paying attention to what the government was doing, including its treaties and laws. This allowed time for the banking procedures and laws to be put in place over time while the nation slept, so the nation could be conquered during the Civil War. The only way to regain this country is with the re-education of the working class, so they can make informed decisions and vote. Well, good luck on that. Vote the mismanagers of our government out of office. As Joseph Stalin said, it's not who votes, it's who counts the votes. We could then reverse the post-Civil War socialist laws and the one-world government laws that have been gradually put in place since the Civil War. Until the defeat of America is recognized, victory will never be obtainable. Only through reliance by faith on Jesus Christ and the teaching of His kingdom will we realize our freedom. As I said earlier, just as this country has been conquered, when Jesus Christ returns, He conquers all nations and takes possession of His kingdom and rules them with a rod of iron. Revelation 11:15-18. His right of ownership is enforced by the law, God Almighty. The following quote is from Thomas Jefferson, quote, "And to preserve their independence, we must not let our rulers load us with perpetual debt. We must make our election between economy and liberty or profusion and servitude. If we run into such debts as that, we must be taxed in our meat and in our drink, in our necessaries and our comforts, in our labors and our amusements, for our callings and our creeds, as the people of England are, our people, like them, must come to labor 16 hours in the 24. Oh, yeah, that's what we have now. and give the earnings of 15 of these to the government for their debts and daily expenses. And the 16th being insufficient to afford us bread, we must live as they do now on oatmeal and potatoes, or TV dinners while the wife's at work as well as the husband, and nobody's watching the child. Have not time to think, no means of calling the mismanagers to account, but be glad to obtain subsistence by hiring ourselves to rivet their chains on the necks of our fellow sufferers. Unquote. Boy, Thomas Jefferson. Boy, he was so quotable and so brilliant, but at the same time, I don't think he understood that the people around him, the elitists around him, sold us out, as James Montgomery documents. All right, I'll just briefly go through some highlights of the voluminous footnotes that, especially just for an essay, that James Montgomery includes here. He starts out with the original charter for Virginia. The next footnote, too, though, look at this. The Paris Peace Treaty, which supposedly ended the Revolutionary War with the United States as supposedly the winner. Well, look how it starts here. This is from the Paris Peace Treaty ending the Revolutionary War. It, having pleased the divine providence to dispose the hearts of the most serene and most potent Prince George III, and it lists all of his titles. One of them is the Prince Elector of the Holy Roman Empire and the United States of America, to forget all past misunderstandings and differences that have unhappily interrupted the good correspondence and friendship which they mutually wish to restore. And it lists the fellow, it goes on from there, it lists the fellow co-signers David Hartley, Esquire, John Adams, Esquire, Benjamin Franklin, Esquire, John Jay, Esquire. Those are all titles of nobility, showing that all four of those men were subject still to the King of Britain. You will find that it's the King dictating the treaty here, dictating the terms of this treaty. The King, the supposed loser of this war, dictating the treaty. You see anything wrong with this picture? Okay, check out Article 4 here. Look how they snuck this in. Article 4 of the Peace Treaty. It is agreed that creditors on either side shall meet with no lawful impediment to the recovery of the full value in sterling money of all bona fide debts heretofore contracted. There you go. Just like David Astle pointed out in the Babylonian Woe, the front man for the bankers, in this case King George III, they will always cover for the bankers, always make sure the bankers, their bosses, get paid. But wait a minute, didn't we win the war and we got to pay the king's bankers still? Okay. But basically, if you go through all the articles in the treaty, you'll see that it is, even as it started out, is the King of England who is setting all of the terms, Article 1, 2, you name it. He was calling the shots. And since when does the loser in a war do that? The King of England was not the loser in that war. Moving on in history and in the footnotes, this is Jay's Treaty from a few years later. Oh, gosh, what year was this? It doesn't say. It'll say at the end, I suppose. But in Jay's Treaty, look at this. Article 2 in Jay's Treaty. His Majesty will withdraw all his troops and garrisons from all posts and places within the boundary lines assigned by the Treaty of Peace to the United States. what were British troops still doing there? Okay, and this was 13 years after the Treaty of Peace was supposed to have removed them. Folks, we didn't win that war. We did not win that war. Moving on. And the king's giving us all of our land that we're already supposed to have in this Jay's Treaty. Article 6. Whereas it is alleged by diverse British merchants and others, His Majesty's subjects, that debts to a considerable amount, which were bona fide contracted before the peace, still remain owing to them by citizens or inhabitants of the United States. Okay, the King of England is still dictating terms to the United States about debt collections for Britain here. You know, he's covering for the bankers again, making sure the king is making sure his banking bosses get paid, so that by the ordinary course of judicial proceedings, the British creditors cannot now obtain compensation for the losses and damages which they have thereby sustained. It is agreed the United States will make full and complete compensation for the same to the said creditors. What is the King of Britain doing dictating that if we really won that war, folks? Okay, Article 12 of Jay's Treaty. His Majesty consents. Dictating again, that it shall and may be lawful, oh thank you, during the time hereinafter limited, for the citizens of the United States to carry to any of His Majesty's islands and ports in the West Indies from the United States in their own vessels, not being above the burthen of 70 tons, any goods or merchandises, being of the growth, manufacture, or produce of the said states. And His Majesty also consents. Look at this. Look at the supposed loser of the war is consenting. The king is this is dictating terms. If the king had lost that war, this wouldn't happen. This is not the way it happened, as James Montgomery pointed out when on the USS Missouri. When General MacArthur arranged the peace, signed the peace treaty with the Japanese, it was MacArthur who dictated the terms because the United States won that war. Did we let Japan dictate the terms? No, because they lost the war. Well, here, the King of England's dictating the terms because America, the United States, did not win that Revolutionary War. And His Majesty also consents. Provided all, giving us our ports and islands. Oh, thanks. Provided always that the said Americans do carry and land their cargoes in the United States only, the United States will prohibit and restrain the carrying of any molasses, sugar, coffee, or cotton in American vessels. Just telling us where we can take our stuff to, where we can ship our goods to, and where we can't. The King of Britain, in Jay's Treaty, is dictating that. Why is the king dictating terms of American trading 13 years after the Treaty of Peace, if America really won that revolution? America didn't really win that American Revolution. Article 18. In order to regulate what is in future to be esteemed contraband of war, all the above, and it lists a ton of stuff here, and it's all munitions. Anything having to do with munitions, petards, mortars, muskets, cannon, bandoliers, gunpowder, etc., etc. All of the above articles are hereby declared to be just objects of confiscation. Why is America agreeing to a wide variety of materiel to be confiscated by the British if America really won that revolution? We didn't win that revolution. Anything else I wanted to show? Maybe that's it. Something else I got highlighted here, and then we'll call it a day. Oh, wow. Congressman Beck had this to say about the 1933 War Powers Act. You'll find this under Congressman James Peck in the Congressional Record of 1933. Quote, "I think of all the damnable heresies that have ever been suggested in connection with the Constitution, the doctrine of emergency is the worst. It means that when Congress declares an emergency, there is no Constitution. This means it's death. But the Constitution of the United States has a restraining influence in keeping the federal government within the carefully prescribed channels of power is moribund, if not dead. We are witnessing its death agonies, for when this bill becomes a law, if unhappily it becomes law, which it did, there is no longer any workable constitution to keep the Congress within the limits of its constitutional powers," unquote. There you go, folks. A congressman in 1933 declared that if the War Powers Act went through, which it did, he said, the country's dead. It's gone. And we were declared in that act alien enemies. And alien enemies, defined in Bouvier's Law Dictionary, they're said to have no rights, no privileges, unless by the king's special favor during time of war. And it's one who owes allegiance to the adverse belligerent. That's us. Congratulations, we're slaves, and we're making bricks for Pharaoh. The difference between a guy like myself and people listening to the show and the rest of the country is we know they don't. They don't know they're slaves, folks. How sad. How sad. Oh, come, Jesus, come. This has been part three and the close of The United States is Still a British Colony by James Montgomery. I tell you what, I'm going to get into just one more essay by James Montgomery. I think it's going to be that the one called A Country Defeated in Victory, because he goes into greater detail on exactly how they pulled off the shenanigans that how the founding quote-unquote fathers pulled off the shenanigans of making us believe the Constitution was one thing when it really was not. It was a... so there'll be a couple more shows about James Montgomery, and that'll be that. But this has been his essay, The United States is Still a British Colony. So stop hearkening. Stop referring back to the Constitution. It meaningless. Gone. It never meant anything. It gave us some privileges. Okay, this has been the Ministry of Truth. I'm Gordon Comstock. Thank you for listening. Over and out. Come, Jesus. Come.